KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In South Dakota, the Senate passed a resolution Wednesday to promote the long-term health and viability of the Black Hills National Forest, brought by Spearfish Republican Senator Randy Dibert. The bill was widely supported, though questions were raised by Oglala Lakota Democratic Senator Red Dawn Foster about issues like tribal involvement in the long-term forest plan and the treatment of old-growth trees. Dibert addressed concerns.
The tribes have a cooperative agency status. It's above and beyond the local governments, so they will have a seat at the table on any action that's taken in the hills. And on the old growth, that's part of their management plan, too. They have guidelines in their management plan when they do a harvest to acknowledge those types of growth and other unique situations.
The Black Hills are considered sacred in Lakota culture, and Indigenous people have historically been underrepresented in decision-making for forest management. On Wednesday, members of the Navajo Nation Council joined Utah state officials and lawmakers at the state capitol in Salt Lake City to celebrate a water rights settlement. The Utah Navajo Nation Water Rights Settlement grants the Navajo Nation a water allocation of 81,500 acre-feet per year, with rights to both surface and groundwater from the Colorado River within Utah. The settlement also includes significant funding for water infrastructure development. Navajo Council members say this comes after years of advocacy and will provide Navajo communities with essential needs, like bringing running water to homes. According to the tribe, there are about 6,000 residents on the Utah side of the Navajo Nation, and about half of them live without running water. Dancers from North Slope Villages recently gathered for Kiviak, a festival in Utqiagvik, Alaska. KMBA's Alaska Desk reporter Alona Niden has more.
Susan Patkatak was not allowed to participate in the Nubiak dancing growing up. But last week, the 19-year-old performed in front of hundreds of people and received a standing ovation. It was a new dance she created that told a story of reconnecting to the tradition.
It's about how I wasn't allowed to dance when I was younger.
Patkatak is a member of Bear Dancers, one of 11 dance groups that took part in Kiviak. The event, also known as the Messenger Feast, brought together at least 700 participants. It included a running race, gift-giving, sharing indigenous food, and, most importantly, Inupiaq dancing. For performers like David Elahguak, it was a chance to reconnect with relatives and friends and uplift each other through the traditional art form.
It's like a healing part of us for coming out of the long, dark winter days.
Kiviak is a long-time tradition held during the years of successful harvests, when coastal Inupiaq tribes would trade their catch and products with their inland neighbors. The tradition was discontinued in the early 20th century because the church viewed Inupiaq dancing as pagan. The festival finally restarted in the late 80s. This year's acts included traditional ceremonial dances, like the box drum dance. The legend behind it describes the mother eagle teaching the Nupiaq people to drum and celebrate. The event also featured some brand new dances, including the one from Patkatak with the Bear Dancers. Patkatak only started dancing 2 years ago, and for a while it was hard for her to be left out of the practice. The lyrics of the song she performed at the recent festival describe the joyful feeling of being a part of the dancing tradition.
We create songs and dances to express ourselves and to express our stories.
Patkatak dedicated her dance to elders and everyone else who yearns to reconnect to their culture. I am Alona Niden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It requires speaking out and standing up, and that requires more than just one or two Republicans.
Senator Lisa Murkowski calls on fellow Republicans to join her in opposing President Trump. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, in his first address to the legislature, Congressman Nick Begich calls for less federal funding for Alaska.
I think this moment highlights the fact that Alaska has become too federally dependent, and we need to increase the diversity of that mix with the private sector.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Senator Lisa Murkowski voted against confirming Kash Patel as President Trump's FBI director today. Murkowski and Senator Susan Collins of Maine were the only Republicans to vote no, so Patel was confirmed. Murkowski said her objections stem from Patel's prior political activities. She wrote in a social media post that the FBI must be trusted to focus on fighting crime and corruption, not on settling political scores. Democrats warn Patel is going to use the FBI to carry out Trump's revenge agenda. Their view is bolstered by a book Patel wrote in 2023 called Government Gangsters. It includes a list of 60, which Patel says is not an enemies list. Murkowski was not convinced.
Basically, it's like his own little hit list, and it's like, that's not appropriate.
Murkowski has voted against two Trump nominees so far this term, Patel and Pete Hegseth, now the Secretary of Defense. In her view, both have taken actions that disqualify them from serving. She's voted for others, like Robert Kennedy for Health Secretary, that she still has serious reservations about, but she says she needs agency leaders to return her calls about Alaska's priorities. And in a town hall last night, Senator Lisa Murkowski criticized President Trump for dismissing thousands of federal employees. She said Congress needs to call him out when he violates his constitutional limits.
If the president, for instance, should seek to withhold federal funding that has already been authorized and appropriated, that violates the Budget Act, it violates the Impoundment Act, and it cannot be allowed to stand.
Murkowski is one of the most watched Republicans in Congress because she's often willing to cross Trump. But she said if Congress is going to hold Trump to the Constitution, more of her colleagues have to join her.
It requires speaking out and standing up. And that requires, again, more than just one or two Republicans. It requires us as a Congress to do so.
More than 1,000 constituents joined the telephone town hall, and many others said they tried to dial in but couldn't get through. Murkowski said no question would be too hard to answer and no one would be cut off. One caller asked her about Trump's stance on Ukraine. Trump on Wednesday called the Ukrainian president a dictator and said falsely that Ukraine was the aggressor with Russia. Murkowski said Trump's insults were uncalled for.
It is wrong to suggest that somehow or other Ukraine started this war, asked for this war. It is clear for all the world to see and to know that Putin invaded Ukraine and started the war.
The senator suggested this may be part of Trump's unorthodox negotiating style, but she said it's head-spinning to hear Trump sound more supportive of Russia's president than Ukraine's. Congressman Nick Begich III told the Alaska legislature today the state has become too dependent on federal spending. The comments in his first address to state lawmakers come as Alaskans reckon with the effects of Trump's broad efforts to cut government and consolidate his power. Begich encouraged anyone affected by the cuts to reach out to his office, but in broad terms, he supported the cost-cutting initiatives of the Trump administration. Days after House Republicans released a budget plan that would add roughly $3 trillion to the federal deficit, Begich called the government's current level of spending unsustainable.
In the short term, we need to make sure that we have the federal support that we need. But I think this moment highlights the fact that Alaska has become too federally dependent, and we need to increase the diversity of that mix with the private sector.
With that, Begich delivered a very different message than the state's congressional delegation has in prior legislative addresses. Instead of trumpeting the dollars he's steered to Alaska, Begich had to explain why money previously set aside for Alaska projects by Congress is not flowing. At the same time, though, Begich offered support for sustaining and expanding aid and infrastructure programs for Alaska, like the Essential Air Service and the ferry system. Begich also said he supported adding work requirements to Medicaid, the federal and state insurance programs supporting children and the poor. He said they would make the programs more sustainable.
The taxpayers are working and paying the taxes. They expect people who receive welfare benefits who are able to work to do so.
Begich applauded the Trump administration's work to remove restrictions on resource development. He said restrictions on things like drilling, mining, and logging were part of the reason the state's economy remains dependent on the federal government. Tinned fish is a revered culinary tradition in Europe. In recent years, the U.S. market for tinned seafood has surged by billions of dollars, and boutique-branded cans of fish are trending on TikTok. And as Caribbean's Jack Darrell reports, at the forefront of this swell is a small family-owned cannery on Prince of Wales Island in southeast Alaska.
Wildfish was founded in the late 80s by a schoolteacher in Kluak named Phyllis Mueller. It's now run by her grandson, Matthew Scaletta. Scaletta is passionate about food. He spent summers cutting fish at the cannery as a kid, and then cut his teeth in the culinary world in Chicago and Portland, everything from bars to fine dining restaurants. And he noticed something.
Places were importing Spanish and Portuguese canned fish. It was kind of quietly, kind of becoming a thing.
Scaletta says at the time, canned salmon stateside was cheap, probably better for stocking a fallout shelter than a charcuterie board. And then he says he saw something that changed everything.
I'm Anthony Bourdain.
That's right.
An episode of Anthony Bourdain's show, No Reservations.
Rest assured, this stuff bears no relationship to the can of smoked oysters you ate stoned and desperate at 2 in the morning back at college. This is the world's very best seafood. And here's what's so mind-blowing. It only gets better in the can.
And it kind of blew my mind to see that, right? And it stuck with me.
So when Scaletta's father and grandmother decided to retire from the cannery, he came home to Alaska and took the reins. This was 2015. Scaletta says he saw a hole in the market.
So I set out to be like the first U.S.-based like high-end like craft cannery. And we're still there. I'm still working on that.
Wildfish's cans of garlic sumac rockfish or smoked coho go for about $10 to $14 a can. Scaletta says since he started smoking salmon for the slightly spendier masses, tinned fish is officially on the map in the U.S., but he doesn't take credit for that.
There were other companies who came in after us who, frankly, just had a lot more money.
Scaletta says his business and tinned fish in general really took off in the U.S. in 2020. The cannery's sales and revenue have only been going up since then, and he hopes to soon expand to a second cannery in Kluak. And he says it's hard to keep his most popular products in stock, maybe partly due to some significant national attention on his company. Marguerite Preston edits the kitchen section of Wirecutter for the New York Times. They mostly do product review type stuff. She says she doesn't normally do the actual reviewing, but she really wanted to write a guide to tinned fish.
I would say in the past maybe 3 years, maybe a little bit longer, we've just seen like this growing interest, these trendy new brands, the beautiful packaging.
So Preston and her team collected over 100 different tins, cans, and jars of fish from Europe, Asia, and the U.S. and laid them all out on the counter of their office in Brooklyn. And don't worry, they split it up over 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, and then we just kind of like went at it and felt really pretty ill at the end of each day, to be honest.
Preston published her findings on the website in December. The guide is like an Olympics for tinned fish. Each category has its world champion. Preston says when it came to sampling salmon, the unanimous favorite was Wildfish Cannery.
You know, I think the thing that stood out the most was the texture. It just had the most kind of like buttery, meaty, succulent texture. Like the level of smoke, you can tell just by looking at them, that have this beautifully kind of like burnished look on top.
Scaletta says it was really cool to see his small cannery getting national press. But the art of canned fish isn't a new idea to an Alaskan. The culture of home canning here was a major inspiration for Wildfish.
As an Alaskan, one of the most precious things that you have, like in your pantry, is your like your home pack, your smoked and jarred salmon, right? There's definitely a component of Wildfish that is like taking what we already had, which was like this culture of like home pack and like the idea of a jar of smoked salmon being elevated and kind of bringing that to the masses.
As tinned fish solidifies itself as a high class snack, Scaletta says Wildfish is going to continue to do what Alaskan canneries have always done, buying high-quality fish from local fishermen and canning it for the masses. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod mushers train during a historically low snow year.
Yes, we do encounter conditions like this in races, but it's not something you want to train on every single day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
The number of Alaska high schoolers who say they've used vapes or e-cigarettes recently is declining. That's according to the latest data from the state's Youth Risk Behavior Survey. The survey shows 26% of high schoolers had vaped in the last 30 days in 2019. By 2023, that percentage dropped significantly to about 17%. Christy Knight heads the tobacco program of the state's Division of Public Health. She says the work the state has done to educate teens about the dangers of vaping is helping.
We did see an improvement in perceptions of harm in 2023, which demonstrates that our education is indeed working and that teens are more aware of how these products can harm their health.
According to the survey, more high schoolers think vaping every day can have serious consequences for their health. More than 40% of high schoolers believed that in 2023, up from about a quarter in 2019. Nicotine vapes may seem like they're made of water vapor, but Knight says they're actually full of aerosolized chemicals and metals.
E-cigarettes include ultrafine particles that can be inhaled deep into the lungs. Some have flavorants such as diacetyl, which is a chemical that has been linked to serious lung disease. Volatile organic compounds such as benzene, which is found in car exhaust. And then heavy metals such as nickel, tin, and lead.
Scientists don't yet have a full understanding of how harmful those chemicals and metals are, but research links vaping to heart and lung disease and asthma. Knight says the rate of high schoolers who report vaping recently is still too high, and the rate of teens vaping frequently has gone up slightly. She says it's especially important to educate this age group about vaping.
Youth are particularly vulnerable to the health risks of e-cigarettes because their brains are still developing until the age of 25. So nicotine in general is a significant risk for teens as that can impact their learning, memory, and attention.
High schoolers also continue to consume fewer cigarettes, cigars, ikmik, and smokeless tobacco than in years before. You can get help quitting nicotine by calling 1-800-QUIT-NOW or texting READY to 34191. An investment by the Alaska Permanent Fund in the seafood processing company Peter Pan was supposed to be an investment in Alaska, but it ended in failure to the tune of more than $29 million. That's because Peter Pan collapsed, resulting in the closure of the fish processing plant in King Cove, its main economic engine. While the players are still sorting through the Peter Pan debacle, there are some big questions about whether the $80 billion permanent fund, that's the state's largest source of income, which also pays residents an annual dividend, should even be investing in Alaska-based companies. Nat Herz with the Northern Journal, in collaboration with ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News, recently wrote about the Peter Pan failure. Herz says an investigation revealed that permanent fund leadership and its hired investment firm, McKinley Capital Management, either missed or ignored some warning signs that Peter Pan was a risky investment.
The job that McKinley, the finance firm, was doing on behalf of the Alaska Permanent Fund was basically going out and looking for companies that sort of had growth potential or were undervalued and that they could sort of buy into and generate more money and sell it off at a big profit. And so one of the companies they ended up focusing in on was this Peter Pan Seafoods, which was a longtime corporation that bought and processed and sold the catch of Alaska fishermen. So they have this enormous plant in King Cove, this small community way out there on the Alaska Peninsula. They had a few other plants kind of scattered across the state. So the idea here was, okay, we'll put new money into these plants, like buy new processing equipment maybe and buy more seafood and raise the level of revenue and throughput in the plants, and then we'll have a much bigger sort of book of sales and we'll be able to sell the company for a big profit.
I mean, that sounds great. So what's the problem with that?
Well, it does sound great, but generally speaking, the seafood industry is a really chaotic and volatile industry where you kind of have boom years and bust years. And so the idea that you could sort of easily build your revenues up and just sort of sell it for a profit, this is a cutthroat industry. It has a lot of other existing players that are trying to maximize profits. And the other thing that really happened here was you had this kind of overall meltdown in global and Alaska seafood markets. And so this reformulated Peter Pan ran right into that.
It sounds like there were some red flags that were missed, but did you see anything in terms of actual malfeasance or anything else shady?
The short answer is no. I mean, I think that's been a lingering sort of challenge to the reporting. I think, you know, certainly people in King Cove are really quick to blame this really colorful seafood industry player, Roger May, who's a very wealthy, kind of flamboyant guy who produces Hollywood movies and hunts for buried treasure and just seems to have all kinds of money everywhere. And actually through sort of this receivership sort of bankruptcy process, ended up with a lot of the company's assets. But I think, you know, you kind of have everyone pointing fingers at each other. I think the permanent fund points fingers at McKinley and says this was a McKinley deal. You end up with McKinley and the other of the three partners in the business deal pointing fingers at Roger May and saying it's his fault. Roger says, it's not my fault. I loaned the company a bunch of money and lost a bunch of my own money. But the fishermen, meanwhile, they're mad and they don't feel like there's been a lot of accountability either. But I don't think sort of we are at the place where we can conclude that sort of any one thing was to blame so much as there was a constellation of things that appear to have contributed to this collapse.
I mean, you mentioned the fishermen in King Cove and that they would be upset by this, but it goes a little bit further than that, right? I mean, in terms of the economic impact in King Cove, and I wonder if you could tell me about that.
Yeah, so one of the major sort of reasons I think I was drawn to this story initially was that you had fishermen who went out, caught fish or had, you know, paid to upgrade their nets and fix things and get their boats out on the water. And we're going to go fish for Peter Pan. And then Peter Pan all of a sudden closed down the plant and said, we, you know, still owe some of these fishermen money from past catch that we bought and sold, but we don't have any money to pay them. So you've got fishermen out tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And beyond that, this is a community that is built on commercial fishing. You know, the huge chunk of King Cove's tax revenue comes from taxes on the catch that's delivered to the processing plant there. It's a huge employer in the community. It's a huge sort of anchor tenant for all these municipal services, power, water, etc. And so without it, you're seeing families moving away. The enrollment at the school has fallen. You have the potential for them to ask the state for, you know, aid, basically a bailout. And I think sort of what is really ironic, and the, another sort of reason I felt like this was really a story that Alaskans needed to know about was, like, we kind of did this to ourselves, right? Like, a state investment that, like, ended up going bad is now leading to, you know, maybe like the slow, or not even so slow, death of this community, and a situation where, like, actually they may need to be coming back to the state for, like, more money. And I think that's, you know, whose fault that is and why exactly it happened. I mean, I think those are actually really important questions that, like, we should be asking ourselves, given that, you know, this happened, if not because of decision, public policy decisions that we made, certainly, like, connected to public policy decisions.
That was Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz. You can find his full story in collaboration with ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News at northernjournal.com or adn.com.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The Western Interior Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will hold a public meeting in Fairbanks February 25th and 26th at Pike's Waterfront Lodge to develop federal wildlife proposals and discuss other subsistence issues. An outreach session with North Pacific Fishery Management Council for chum salmon bycatch is February 25th. Info at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Thirty teams set out from Big Lake Saturday for the 2,500-mile Iron Dog snow machine race, and at the halfway point in Nome, only 18 remained. The teams took a long layover in Nome Wednesday to work on their machines and prepare for the back half of the race. Team 20's Robbie Shackle and Bradley George were the first into Nome. After hitting a berm Tuesday, George and his snow machine careened off the side of a bridge 20 miles from Nome. Yesterday, the team repaired a handful of broken parts, with each minute counting against their course time. George said the team had a clean race up to that point.
To do something like that, it's super, super unfortunate. Those are the stupid mistakes that take you out of the race.
Team 14's Casey Boylan and Brian Leslie were second to arrive in Nome and had mechanical issues of their own. The team pulled apart their sleds over wrench day to fix a sensor. Then later, the team realized they missed six bolts, which were hastily replaced on the restart line Thursday morning before getting underway. Former champion Tyson Johnson and his partner Tom Davis experienced mechanical issues and scratched last night. Despite slow, snowless conditions through a 60-mile segment of trail known as the Farewell Burn, the race's director Mike Vassar says the return route will remain unchanged.
There's no way to reroute around it. I mean, if you look at the course times from last year from Big Lake to McGrath, and you look at the course times this year from Big Lake to McGrath for the lead teams, it's only an hour and 30 minutes longer. So it's not like it's that bad.
Wilson Hugendorn and Bubba McDaniel said Wednesday that they've devised a plan for the Farewell Burn, but like other racers, are keeping their cards close to their chests.
So we've got something going on in McGrath right now that we're going to, hopefully it's going to help us make better progress through the burn back towards to Rome.
The 1,000-mile journey back to Big Lake is underway today. Observers and checkpoints along the route have reported mechanical issues plaguing a number of sleds. The race is expected to conclude Saturday. Iditarod sled dog teams will now dash out of Fairbanks in under 2 weeks because of Bear Trail farther south. Mushers in south central Alaska have been battling the low snow conditions for months. And as Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, where and how they've been preparing for the race looks different this year.
Four sled dogs pull Ryan Reddington on a four-wheeler around a lake in Kinnick, about an hour north of Anchorage. It's about 20 degrees, the sun is beaming through a few clouds, and the pavement in the parking lot is bone dry. He says he'd normally be training on a sled, but it's been months since a big snowfall.
When we get on a sled, it's a lot more fun. They're a fun group. On a sled, it's really something.
Reddington and his team will soon compete in the 1,000-mile Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Reddington won the race in 2023. It's a competition his grandfather founded half a century ago. A lot has changed over the years. For the third time in a decade, the teams are leaving out of Fairbanks because a bear trail on part of the route out of Willow, not far from Reddington's home. Reddington says training conditions in Kinnick have been tough, bumpy, and icy for the last few months. Several generations of his family and their dog teams have run on these Kinnick trails, but Reddington says he's never seen them this bad.
It's trails that I grew up mushing on, and shocking to see it like this. The last year it was like this, I think, was 2003 and 2001. Hoping for snow, as always, but it never comes.
The area saw several feet of snow last year, but right now there's only about an inch on the ground, forcing Reddington and his dogs to spend more time training about 3 hours north on Lake Louise.
I think we broke about 9 different sleds this year, and it was difficult to put the miles on. We've had to travel north, and it makes it more expensive, but we got to do what we have to do to get miles and prepare the dogs.
Down on the Kenai Peninsula, 3-time Iditarod champion Mitch Seavey says recent high temperatures and rain created icy conditions that were tough to train on at times, even on ATVs.
The low snow isn't too bad because we do train on side-by-sides and four-wheelers, but occasionally we get rain and ice, and then it's slippery and not very good for even wheeler training.
Seavey travels with his team every year and has since his first Iditarod in 1982. He says it's standard for mushers to travel to train, not just in low snow years. Back up in Kinnick, 12-time Iditarod finisher Anna Barrington also says her team always travels, but she says never as much as this year. They've gone to Eureka, Cantwell, and Petersville. She says her dogs light up when they're loading up for a road trip because they know they're headed somewhere with better snow conditions.
The song Johnny Cash, I've Been Everywhere, pops into my head. It's good for them to run on different things, and they're not always running on the same trails. It challenges their bodies and minds in different ways to run different places.
Barrington was training on her sled in November, the earliest she ever has. Now, she says those once snowy trails are icy, bare, and brown. Training in minimal snow wears down sleds quickly, so like Reddington, she swaps her sled for a four-wheeler when on her icy home trails. It's not ideal, she says.
There's a lot of ice, very low snow cover, and it's not good for long runs. And yes, we do encounter conditions like this in races, but it's not something you want to train on every single day for long miles or many hours.
Barrington says she'll keep an extra close eye on how her dogs are moving and their hydration if there's low snow on the trail. In Kinnick, I'm Ava White.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Jack Darrell in Ketchikan, Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Ava White out there in Kinnick. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer. This is Johnny Cash, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Used to be that I believed in something. Used to be that I believed in love. It's been a long time since I've had that feeling I could love someone.
could trust someone. I said I'd never let nobody near my heart again, darling. I said I'd never let nobody in. But if you ask me to, and just might change my mind and let you in my life forever. If you ask me to, and just might give my heart and stay here in your arms forever. If you ask me to,
clouds your mind with emotion. Not some sit down. Stand up. Sit down. Stand up.
I'm still awake. Can you help me unravel my latest mistake? I don't love him. Winter just wasn't my season. Yeah, we walked through the door so accusing. Their eyes like they have any right at all to criticize. Hypocrites, you're all here for the very same reason. 'Cause you can't jump the track. We're like cars on a cable, and life's like an hourglass glued to the table. No one can find the rewind button, girl. So cradle your head in your hands and breathe. Just breathe. Oh. Just today.
face, sit down to the flask, and his fist ain't been sober since maybe October of last year. Here in town you can tell he's been down for a while, but my God, it's so beautiful when the boy smiles, wanna hold him. Maybe I'll just sing about it, 'cause he can't jump the track. We're like cars on a cable, and life's like an hourglass glued to the table. No one can find the rewind button, boys, so cradle your head in your hand. Inside of me, threatening the life it belongs to. And I feel like I'm naked in front of the crowd, 'cause these words are my diary, screaming out loud. And I know that you'll use them however you want to, but you can't jump the track. We're like cars on a cable, and life's like an hourglass glued to the table. No one can find the rewind button now. You sing it if you understand. Yeah.
Get it up. your body.
You better get it right.
Step away.